supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little bit later in the show, we'll talk about how to use horticultural vinegars to kill weeds. In lawns, maybe, maybe not. We'll certainly talk about weed control in lawns. And we have a great interview coming up on new research working with old grapes to create wine grape varieties that are naturally resistant to disease. So we got to get right to your fascinating phone calls to get all that in at 1-888-346-9499. Max, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I'm good, Max. How are you, sir?
Good. I'm calling from Newark, Delaware.
Excellent. Excellent. You know the drill, but I just want to point out my son's name is Max as well.
Oh, great.
Now,
good name.
Are you a Maximilian, a Maxwell, or just Max?
Just Max.
All right. Same as my son. I love that name. You know, what can we do for the man with a great name in Newark, Delaware?
Okay, I have a Diphidenia, which
that's
people
something.
Think Mandevillas are the same thing, but
I see.
From looking it up, I noticed there is a difference, and this is the second year we brought it indoors. Every time we shake it, it almost looks like it's snowing a little bit because of these cute little white flies.
They're cute?
They're flying around.
You're the first.
Well, they look cute while they're flying around.
You're the first person in the history of horticulture to use the word cute and white fly in the same sentence that did not also involve the word dead. <You know? laughs>
We've been losing leaves. Now, I understand that the flowers do die off this time of year. It was real lush when we brought it in. But we are losing a lot of leaves. It was fine last winter, survived. We took it outside. It was beautiful all year long.
And same conditions. You're treating it essentially the same way this winter. Same light, same watering schedule.
Yes.
Now, you don't use chemical fertilizer on this plant, do you?
No, we don't.
Okay. Yeah, because that's the only thing you could have done that would have led these insects to you. Indoor plants are very prone to these creatures. And although they overwinter in warmer climates, I don't think there's any part of the United States that does not have whitefly populations in the summertime. And so you don't have to do anything wrong to get whitefly on your plants. And it would not be unusual for them to be really stressing the heck out of a tropical plant that has come indoors in the wintertime. Now, have you tried anything yet?
I did get an insecticidal soap, and I also bought these strips that I was thinking about hanging up.
And what are the strips?
They're called sticky whitefly trap.
Are they yellow in color? Okay, you got it in hand, Max. You are right there. The big natural control in greenhouses is to surround the plants with yellow sticky traps. White flies, for some reason, are tremendously attracted to a specific range of the color yellow. And it's funny, a researcher once told me that it was the same exact color as the Rust-Oleum yellow that was available in spray cans on the market at that time. And that in big greenhouses, they used to buy Rust-Oleum and spray cardboard with it and then coat the cardboard with a sticky substance and hang those, you know, giant yellow windows all throughout the greenhouse. And they'd be covered with white flies. So you are on the right track. I would suggest you surround the plant at all levels with a couple of these yellow sticky traps. Depending on the size of this plant, I would put one in the soil on each side. How tall is the plant total?
Oh, I would say 3 to 3.5 feet tall.
I would do 2 or 3 levels of yellow sticky traps on, you know, kind of alternating on the different sides of the plants. You are going to get a tremendous amount of white flies. When the yellow gets hard to see, when it's so covered with insects, I want you to replace it and do that until the levels seem to be leveling off a little bit. And then I want you to go in and I want you to use your insecticidal soap to rinse off every leaf that you can get at. Wait like an hour and then rinse the entire plant off with cool water so you don't get any negative effects from the soap residue on the leaves of the plants, because insecticidal soap acts by smothering. There's no residual effect. It forms a bubble that they can't breathe through. And then after that, I would keep some yellow sticky traps around the plant all winter long, just in case you got some hiding somewhere. And that'll catch them before they can start breeding. But it sounds like you have exactly the right material. You're on exactly the right track to control this problem naturally.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's a relief.
Yeah. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Corrine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, thank you.
Hello, Corrine. How are you?
Hello. Fine, thank you. And you?
Good, good. Where are you, Corrine?
Great. I'm in Jonesboro, Tennessee.
Excellent. What can we do for Corrine in Tennessee?
I was given a composter. It's like a big barrel that you're supposed to turn.
Right.
Plank it.
Mm-hmm.
I tried using it, and for whatever reason, it's not happening right.
Well, what are you putting into it, Corrine?
Vegetables, fruits, weeds, leaves, whatever I can find. I've been dumping in there.
Okay, well, you need to pay a little bit more attention to the mix of elements. Now, obviously, we're talking in the deep winter. And even Tennessee is pretty cold right now.
Yes.
When did you get the composter, and when did you start putting material into it?
Well, I got it last year, and I tried it spring to early summer, and then finally I gave up. And I heard you the other week, and I said, maybe he knows.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm calling to find out what I've been doing wrong.
What most people don't realize is that a compost tumbler or an open bin or a static black plastic a composter, none of these things are meant to just recycle green waste, whether it's kitchen garbage or even spent plants from the lawn. In fact, no green waste actually becomes the finished compost. What becomes the finished compost is very much the same as happens in the great hardwood forests of America, in that it is the browns, the dry browns, the really blasted plants from the previous year, and mostly the fall leaves that return their nutrients to the soil, eventually in the form of composting. And when we get these devices and when we manipulate the material, we imitate nature, trying to control it a little bit and move it around a little bit more quickly. So I will tell you that your composter is always going to be kind of an unnatural garbage dump unless you start with 3/4 well-shredded fall leaves. That is the secret of composting. In fact, the dirty little secret of composting that most people don't realize is that you can greatly compost leaves alone. If all you do is collect and shred all the fall leaves on your property and put some of them in this tumbler, put some of them in a big wire bin, all of them will become fabulous compost. Now, the best thing you can add to the shredded leaves in a cranked tumbler like yours is coffee grounds. They are pretty much the only thing that comes out of our kitchen that's nitrogen rich. You won't hurt the finished compost by tossing in the occasional chopped up broccoli stalk or apple core or the outside spoiled leaves of lettuce, but it won't contribute much nutrition to the process. And should that green waste become more than, say, 1/3 of the material, then it'll just turn into a slimy mess, which unfortunately I kind of guess you've experienced already.
Yes.
Now, if you have a lot of kitchen waste and you don't want to go to a lot of trouble turning that crank and especially collecting and shredding all the fall leaves, very easy to get a worm bin that goes under your sink or in your garage, and those worms will process garden waste and kitchen waste alone into fabulous super premium compost.
May I ask you something? Does it matter what trees I get the leaves from?
No, not really. I mean, you don't want to put a lot of black walnut leaves in.
Well, no, but I have a big maple tree.
They're
I
great.
Get a lot of leaves from.
Yeah, but they must be shredded because whole leaves will mat down. As you've noticed on your lawn and your garden itself,
right.
Whole leaves will mat down. So most people run them over with a lawnmower, or they buy a very inexpensive leaf blower that has a reverse setting that sucks the leaves up through the machine. And that shreds them and puts them in a bag. And then it's very easy to empty the bag into your tumbler. Matter of fact, that's exactly what I do with mine. And in my tumbler, I fill it with shredded leaves. I turn it around a couple of times. And then over the course of the next month or two, I put all my coffee grounds in there and keep turning it. And by spring, I have fabulous compost. So if you don't want to mess with this stuff, get yourself a worm bin, mix your kitchen garbage into that as instructed. You'll be very happy. You got some choices now, and I think you're going to do much better with that tumbler.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Take care now.
Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn our fabulous WQUB listeners and everybody in the environs of beautiful Quincy, Illinois, that I will appear at this year's edition of your wonderful Master Gardeners Conference, The Gardener's Palette, on Saturday, March 5th. Hey, that's soon! But don't you go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with an interview on a new way to breed disease-free grapes and how to use vinegar to control weeds in your garden. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Weed-Free Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You found You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, it's perhaps the ultimate and most satisfying DIY. Home roasted coffee. I mean, who would let a little smoke get in the way of a perfect cup, right? Well, join us for the details. That's this week on The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Today at noon on WHYY.
A year after the earthquake, WHYY's Susan Phillips is back in Haiti and is blogging about her experience of Haiti and the quake's aftermath. You can find Susan's latest post at newsworks.org.
Supporting WHYY, Athena Health, helping eligible physicians receive federal stimulus reimbursement while delivering quality patient care. More about their integrated cloud-based billing, practice management, and EHR services is at athenahealth.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how to use horticultural vinegars and other non-chemical weed controls correctly. And, of course, lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for the interview I've been promising you on disease-free wine grapes. Now it is time to welcome our very special guest, Dr. Walter Gassman, a researcher in the Bond Life Sciences Center and associate professor of plant sciences in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources at the University of Missouri. He comes to us through the fine studios of KBIA on the campus of the University of Missouri. Dr. Gassman, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you on the show, as I am a big fan of wine. And you are doing some exciting research in wine. But before we get started with the actual specifics, one thing in the release about your research absolutely floored me. It said that Missouri used to be one of the top wine grape growing states in the nation.
That's correct. So before Prohibition, it was number two, behind New York. California wasn't on the map yet for grapevine.
Really? But, I mean, there was a lot of grape growing going on in California at the turn of the century, but I guess mostly for personal consumption at that point, really? Not a lot of production?
Not a lot of production for wine, yes.
Now, what kind of grapes were being grown in Missouri before Prohibition? The same kind as today, or was it very different?
I would assume it is very similar to today. The soil hasn't changed, the climate hasn't changed, so the grapevines that do well in this climate, in this area, would have been doing well back then as well. And we have some newer varieties that came from crossbreeding, but other than that, it would have been the same grapevines.
But they would have also had the same basic problem that you're always going to have with any disease-prone crop in Missouri. And it's impossible for people who have not lived there or traveled there in the summer to understand. It is not a joke when I say that when I was in Missouri in August, it was the most intense humidity I have ever experienced in my life. And I never would have anticipated it because people from outside the state don't think of it as this super humid environment in the summer, but it is, right?
Yes, it is. And that's perfect for powder mildew. It likes high humidity. In the evenings when it cools off a little bit, you know, in the 80s, that's perfect growing conditions for powder mildew.
Which is going to attack, geez, a good half of the food crops, if not more, that a backyard gardener would especially grow. Just about all the fruiting crops are prone to this disease, right?
That's right. Different plants are attacked by different types of powder mildew. They are different species of fungi that attack different plants, but they're collectively called powder mildews because of their appearance on the leaf as a powdery substance. But yes, perfect growing conditions for powder mildew.
So I would imagine, and we'll talk about the type of wines that were produced in a moment, but I would imagine that before Prohibition, either they had to thin the clusters, which is something I'm always talking to my listeners about, the importance of grapevines are basically just super vigorous plants, and they need to have their leaves thinned and their clusters thinned on a regular basis throughout the summer. And I presume that old school control was around in the 20s and such. But what kind of agricultural chemicals or controls would they have used back then? Do you know?
People relied very much on the innate resistance of plants like Norton to powder mildew back then. So there were specific types of grapes that were just known to do well.
You've dropped the name into the conversation. This is the grape that you're doing research on right now, and I will tell you, I was a little surprised because I've been around this business about 30 years. I've never grown grapes personally. I enjoy drinking red wine from California quite a bit, and I know the other types of what I consider dessert wine grapes, but I've never heard of Norton. And the first time I read about your research, I laughed out loud because all I could think of was the character Art Carney used to play in The Honeymooners, having a grape named after him. What kind of a grape is Norton? What kind of a wine do you make from it?
Well, it's named after Dr. Daniel Norton, who was a hobby grapevine grower, and he came across this well-growing plant when other grapevines around it were stricken by powdery mildew, and he propagated it. We think it's actually a hybrid between a European-type grapevine and a grapevine species native to North America. And what is, there are many native grapevine species here in North America that are resistant to powder mildew. What is special about Norton is that it's an older hybrid that was propagated for good fruit. So you have the advantage of having good fruit and the resistance to powder mildew that wild grapevines that you find out in nature, but you wouldn't want to use their fruit for making any wine or eating their grapes. But those two features have been combined in Norton, and it's been very popular here since.
Now, you mentioned wild grapes. I mean, these are notoriously pestiferous plants now in some parts of the country. And I agree with what you're saying. The fruit is suitable for wildlife. It's very important for wildlife. But as I don't need to tell you in the environment that you're in, some of these wild grape varieties get out of hand real fast.
Yes, that's right, especially when humans disturb natural growth. They've learned to deal with the humidity, the high temperatures in the summer, the cold temperatures in the winter, and the disease pressure. So they're doing fine. And the particular species that Norton has incorporated is called Vitis estivalis. And you can find pure Vitis estivalis here in Missouri and other southern states growing out in nature.
Vitis being the genus for the grape plant.
Correct. And Vitis vinifera being the European type grape that is notorious for being susceptible not just to powdery mildew, but many other diseases as well.
Oh, yeah. And the phylloxera, the little root devouring
Correct.
Insect creature in California. It would seem, to my experience, the finer the grape, the finer the wine it produces, the more of a drama queen the plant is, which is very common in the plant world.
Correct, because humans picked it not for disease resistance or this and that. It's for the pleasure that we derive from the plant, and those two things don't always go together.
Well, your research is very exciting, and I can hear everybody in the South perking up, hoping they're going to hear something about getting another tool to use in the arsenal against powdery mildew. But before we move on to that, you haven't answered my question. What kind of wine do we get out of this thing?
Yeah, so if you ask me personally, I think you can get very good wine out of Norton. It's not a dessert wine. It's a very full-bodied red wine that you can get out of Norton.
Really?
You do have to know how to make wine from Norton, because one reason Norton is probably so resistant to many diseases is because it makes a lot of what we call secondary metabolites.
Mm-hmm.
And they give a certain taste to the grapes and the wine that you make from it. So you have to know how to make wine out of Norton. Missouri knows how to make it. I don't think I'm in a position to tell you exactly which wineries I prefer, but you can definitely find very good Norton here in Missouri.
Are you saying with the right winemaker and the right aging process, and perhaps with a little bit of blending, which all the fine French and California wines do, whether they admit it on the bottle or not, you can get something, not that approaches a good Cabernet as Zinfandel or Merlot, but something that more than a dessert wine, a Concord grape wine?
No, I would say it's, Nortons have won competitions against French wines, California wines.
Ooh.
So I would not put a limit on what Norton can do. It is a little different. So it depends on how particular you are. If you're feeling adventurous, a Norton can taste very good to you. If you have a preconceived notion of what a red wine should taste like, a Norton might not be good for you.
Back in the 1800s, some guy named Norton used the natural disease-resistant properties of wild grape to make a drinking grape, let's call it, that grew well in what is one of the most humid summer environments in all of America. What are you doing now whereby you hope, I perceive, to isolate this characteristic and perhaps pass it on to other grapes? Because as you know, everybody who grows grapes in a hot, humid summer has the same issues.
Yes. So this is a collaboration that I have with colleagues at the Missouri State University in Springfield, actually in the fruit experiment station in Mountain Grove, an hour outside of Springfield. And they have, as you mentioned, old Norton vines that they have used to cross to Cabernet Sauvignon, for example. So we are using modern genomics and genetic tools to understand the genetic basis for the enhanced resistance that Norton displays.
I would imagine every grape variety we have on the planet right now that anybody can grow is still either the equivalent of an open pollinated variety, a pure strain, or the result of some accidental or purposeful hybridization, right?
Yes, that's right. And The problem with grapevine is that you get in what we call inbreeding suppression very quickly. So once you have your favorite grapevine, you can't propagate it by crossing it back to itself. That's why most grapevines are grafted onto, so you basically vegetatively reproduce grapevines to keep the characteristics that you've so carefully honed over hundreds of years. So you're correct. Grapevines are all a mix of genotypes, but the favored varieties that are grown are all basically the European type of grapevine, Vitis vinifera. So the genetic basis of all the grapevines grown in the world is very narrow. And I think what we can do is bring in valuable traits from a little farther apart than what's been done in the past.
Well, keep up the good work. Dr. Walter Gassman is an associate professor of plant sciences in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources at the University of Missouri. He joined us today from the studios of KBIA on the campus of the University of Missouri. Dr. Gassman, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a real pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Bob calling from Traverse City, Michigan.
All right. Bob knows the drill. Excellent.
I do indeed.
You get a gold star and a little Halloween sticker on your paper. What can we do for you, Bob?
It's wintertime here now, and we're using our wood burner. And we use, we get about 2 cubic feet of wood ash about once a week, and I'm wondering if I can just sprinkle this in my garden. I've got it in the backyard. It's about 25 feet by 75 feet. It's got a lot of natural sand in it, but I also put all my shredded leaves in it each year.
Okay.
I was just wondering if I could use wood ash as part of my composting.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're tired of gardening and you don't ever want to see a green plant again.
Oh, really?
Yes. Wood ash is not to be composted, not to be applied directly to a garden outside of very special situations. First of all, you know, composting, the whole theory of composting is you compost raw ingredients, regular things from nature. The bulk of a compost pile should always be shredded fall leaves, and then you can mix in small amounts of green material. But if you think about wood ash from a fireplace or a wood stove, it has already been transformed. It's already finished. It's already a changed material. It's no longer raw. You have, in essence, composted it for its energy, which you have enjoyed by not freezing to death for another day in Michigan.
Yes. Okay, so I'm not going to do anything like that again in my garden.
How about
a related one?
No, wait a minute. You mean you did spread the wood ash in your garden?
Oh, yes.
When?
Last winter I did it.
Oh, man. So you didn't have a very good garden last year.
Actually, my tomatoes were wonderful last year. The peppers worked real well. The cucumbers were not as good as they could have been, but the squash did fine, too.
Well, here's the deal. Wood ash does serve a horticultural purpose. Like agricultural lime, it can be added to highly acidic soils to bring them up to neutral.
Mm-hmm.
You may have, just through dumb luck, had a soil that was very acidic and used an amount of wood ash that brought it up to neutral without taking it too high.
Okay.
That's the only explanation, because most people who admit that they put wood ash on the garden, nothing grew there for years afterwards. So certainly do not add any more to your garden.
I will not do that from this point on.
Do you have a lawn as well?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Get a soil test done at Michigan, whoever the soil lab is in Michigan State.
It's the Michigan State University Extension.
So call your extension agent. You want two soil tests. You want to test the soil in your lawn, the soil in your garden. I predict the soil in your garden, because you have already ashed it, is going to be up around 7, which is the high end. That's neutral.
Right.
But plants prefer like 6.5 to 7, most of them. So if that's the case, you got away with murder and don't add any wood ash. But if your soil is naturally acidic, and Michigan is a very high rainfall state, and there's a lot of acid rain out there. So it would not be unusual for your soil to have been very much on the acidic side, quote-unquote, naturally. So see what the lawn is. And if your lawn is like 5.5 or 6, they will give you what is called a liming recommendation, which is an amount of lime to add to the lawn to bring it up to normal. You would substitute your wood ash for the lime because it is just as good as bringing pH up, and you would use 1.25 times as much lime. In other words, if they tell you to do a pound of lime per 1,000 square feet, you use a pound and a quarter. If they tell you to use 4 pounds, you use 5 pounds of wood ash, right around that. And that will actually bring the pH up as well as lime, but add important nutrients to your lawn.
Very good.
But don't add any more without a soil test, and never put wood ash or any material like that into a compost pile.
Well, I have now learned how to do it, so thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right, Bob. Good luck, man.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who has to deal with frozen precipitation in the winter not to use rock salt anywhere near lawns or other plants, or any place else for that matter. Products containing calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, and potassium chloride are much gentler on adjacent plant life, and carports, bridges, highways, and our fragile waterways as well. But don't you go ditching your NaCl just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get the best use out of horticultural vinegars and other organic weed controls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Wagner Free Institute of Science will offer a free series of classes on invasive plants at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society headquarters at 20th and Arch Streets on Wednesday, January 19th, and then on 5 successive Monday evenings. It's free, but you must pre-register. The PHS City Gardening Series will offer a free seed starting class this Tuesday at 2 at the Doylestown Public Library. And PHS's Garden Tenders will help you start up a community garden with a 4-hour basic training course on turning vacant lots into urban oases on Saturday, January 29th, beginning at 9 a.m. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
The directors of True Grit join us today for Fresh Air Weekend. Joel and Ethan Cohen talk about the challenges of making their new Western, from horse wrangling to using biblical language, which they vaguely remember from Hebrew school. Join us at 1 today for Fresh Air Weekend here on WHYY. Forecast for today, sunshine now, but clouds move in later on. High temperature today about 34. There is a chance for flurries this evening into the overnight. Low dipping to about 26 overnight, and then tomorrow sunny skies, but cold. Cold and windy for Sunday, the high about 32. Right now it's 33 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, how to get the best use out of horticultural vinegars and other organic weed controls, with a special emphasis on controlling weeds in lawns without chemicals. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Dwayne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. I burn wood to heat our house and generate a 5-gallon bucket of wood ash about every 10 days.
Okay. Where are you, Dwayne?
I'm in Boyertown.
Boyertown, Pennsylvania. I know it well. All right, and so you burn a lot of wood to heat your house. You got a lot of ash.
Well, last winter I put quite a lot, maybe about 25 gallons of this ash in my compost pile.
Yikes!
And spread the compost over my garden in early spring before I dug it up. And remember, it was a dry year, and lots of garden things didn't do very well. So some of the seeds just didn't germinate. Carrots, spinach, Swiss chard, and lettuce didn't germinate very well. And I don't know how much of the germination problem was too much ash or whether it was dry weather. And I guess the question is, how do you put wood ash to good use?
Oh, Dwayne, you're trying to wiggle out of killing your garden last year, man. The hot weather had nothing to do with it. You are 105% responsible for all the plant death last year. One thing people don't realize about wood ash, it is pure alkalinity. So when you talk about alkaline, you're talking about like Death Valley and the alkaline deserts and things like that, where plants do not naturally grow. It's kind of a killing field. Now, there are good uses for wood ash, but whatever moved you to put so much of it into a compost pile without looking it up first?
Well, I guess I just overdid it.
So here's the deal. You never put wood ash or lime into a compost pile. A compost pile should be composed of organic materials, ideally mostly shredded fall leaves with a little bit of green kitchen waste or coffee grounds or manure in there, and then you let that return to soil. Matter of fact, wood ash can stop a compost pile, a dead cold. But there are horticultural uses for wood ash. It turns out that wood ashes are very similar in effect to agricultural lime. And many people in your part of the country do have occasion to lime their lawns every couple of years if the soil has crept to a point where it is too acidic for the lawn to prosper well. Now, most people do this without a soil test. They read somewhere they're supposed to lime their lawn. So over time, they achieve the same thing you do. They turn that lawn into a killing field by not stopping and thinking about what they're doing. But if a soil test, which in Pennsylvania is dirt cheap, you get, that's a bad pun, you get them through the Extension Service, it tells you all sorts of great things about your soil, the nutrients that are in it, the things it needs. But perhaps the most important measure is your soil pH. 7 is neutral, neither acidic nor alkaline. You put your finger into a soil with a pH of 7 and you taste it, and you should get no taste other than doit. You put it into acidic soil and lick your finger, you will get a sharp acid-like taste. And if you were to put your finger into the soil that you heaved all that wood ash into, the soil would taste sweet. That's why farmers will sometimes talk about sweetening up their soil. They're adding lime or wood ash, and doing it by taste very often, the old school guys, to bring the soil up to the pH level they want. Now, obviously, your soil is probably alkaline and may even need some natural treatments to bring the pH down. I would separately test your garden soil, because if it tests out at 7.5 or 8 or some highly alkaline number, you will want to bring it down with sulfur or peat moss or something to establish a place where plants can grow happily again.
Well, good. You caught me before I made the same mistake this year. I haven't put any wood ash in my compost yet.
Good, good, good.
Thank you very much.
All right, Dwayne. Very common mistake. Don't feel bad. This is the only way men learn.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Suzanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, how nice of you to welcome me as well. Nobody, you have good manners, Suzanne. Where are you?
I'm calling from Harleysville, Pennsylvania.
I know where that is. That's where they make all the motorcycles. All right. What can we do for Suzanne?
I was listening to the show last week, and you mentioned the possibility of using algae for mulch. And this really got my husband and I very excited, because we have a pond, about 13 by 15 foot pond in our backyard, which we put in. It's man-made, and it gets about 6 hours a day of full sun. And by June, we spend a couple of hours every week pulling out algae out of this pond.
Let's slow down a little bit. Now, you have algae form on the surface of the water because it sounds like it doesn't get enough sun.
No, actually, it's forms on the rocks in the water, but not so much on the surface.
Why do you bother with it, then, may I ask?
Well, it eventually will grow and grow and grow and really looks crappy, and I guess that's why we pull it out, but it really partakes the whole pond.
Isn't it a lot of work to get algae off of rocks?
Oh, we're in there. We scrub with brushes. We've tried dozens of different methods. We've tried vacuuming it out. The best method is getting in there with our water shoes and just bending down and pulling it out. It takes a couple of hours every week to do it.
Now, is there any life in this pond? Are there any fish or anything like that?
We have some local fish that are in the pond.
Because typically in a good ecosystem, a complete ecosystem, you would have creatures in there processing the algae. Now, I don't want to neglect to answer your perceived question, because you used the term mulch, and I think you meant into a compost pile.
Compost, thank you. Yes, that's what I meant.
You are absolutely correct about that part. Algae, any kind of scum from a pond, the silt off the bottom of the pond, the remains of aquatic plants, all that stuff from a pond is tremendous plant food after it goes through the composting process. That's why people buy these expensive fish and seaweed emulsions and solutions and fertilizers, because the micronutrient content of things like algae and seaweed, these plant-like materials that exist in watery environments, the micronutrient content is off the chart. It is great stuff. Yes, anytime you get algae out of your pond, it should be mixed in to your compost pile, which I hope has a lot of shredded leaves in it. And when that material becomes compost, it is better compost than I make.
Great.
Because of the material from the pond. I would think that if you get the right kind of life in that pond, that there shouldn't be so much of it that this becomes an arduous task as opposed to, say, a once-a-year harvest, like a grain harvest for your compost pile. And I will ask if you've tried a great trick that has been recommended to me that every pond owner I've talked to has reported success with, which is barley straw.
Yes, we have tried barley straw, and we have not found it to be particularly helpful.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then you've done the number one thing to control algae. Congratulations. Your instincts are correct. This is great material for your compost pile. I just feel bad thinking of you putting all this work out. Why don't you do a little bit of research and see if there's some sort of aquatic life that you can introduce into the pond that would be a natural form of life that wouldn't cause problems if it escaped your pond during, like, heavy rains or a flood or something like that, that would be the equivalent of the algae eater in a home aquarium.
So you're thinking about an animal or a fish, that kind of...
Yes, absolutely. And I know there's many forms of insect and amphibian life and many fish that are algae eaters, for lack of a better term.
That would be great.
Now, first of all, yes, you're absolutely right. Get all the algae you collect into your compost pile, and you'll never be sorry about it. But if you come up with the right creature for this, give us a call back and tell us what it is.
I will. Thanks so much, Mike. I appreciate it. And really love your show. I can't say that I use everything that I learn on it, but it is a real inspiration.
I feel the same way myself.
Thanks.
All right, Suze, thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, killing weeds with vinegar. We start out with a great question from Barbara in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who writes, I don't use chemicals on my lawn, but I just learned that my wonderful daughter and son-in-law have hired a chemical lawn care company to get rid of their weeds. I've heard you speak about using a vinegar with 20% acidity to achieve the same end. I went to a large garden center, but they didn't have it. please tell me where I can get 20% vinegar. And please provide any man-to-man information I can share with my son-in-law. My daughter wants my grandchildren to be able to walk barefoot on that lawn, so we really need your sensible advice. Well, Barb, some people get mad at me when I take this high road, but I feel strongly that the job of parents is to protect their children's health, not to take risks with it. Many of the herbicides in use today are hormonal disruptors, and to me it's the height of madness to expose small children, whose hormones are very easily influenced, to anything that could possibly harm them. Now, will the kids definitely be harmed? What's the absolute risk? To me, these are meaningless questions. Chemical herbicides are 100% unnecessary, making any risk a foolish one. That's right, unnecessary. The dirty little secret lawn care companies don't want you to know is that the most important factors for keeping a lawn as free of weeds as possible have nothing to do with chemicals or organics. It's all in the cutting, watering, seeding, and feeding. If your son-in-law has a lawn composed of cool season grasses, the norm in New Jersey and similar climes, and cuts it or allows it to be cut below 3 inches, weeds are inevitable. If he feeds it or allows others to feed it any other time than spring and fall, weeds are inevitable. And if he waters for short periods of time, that's right, weeds are inevitable. To achieve the least amount of weed in the lawn in the north, the grass must be 3 inches high after every cutting. Never cut the lawn during a dry heat wave or feed it in the summer. If nature has not provided an inch of water that week, water deeply overnight, ending at 7 or 8 a.m. Do those things, all free of cost and risk, and you will have prevented a good three-quarters of potential weed problems, maybe closer to 90%. Now to directly answer your question. An internet search of the phrase horticultural vinegar immediately brought up a dozen organic products that are readily available, ranging in strength from 8% acidity to 20%. Because they're liquid, they're expensive to ship. So a vinegar you want, try and get a local garden center that offers organic options to stock a few brands. Just be aware that while residual vinegar won't harm people, pets, or water supplies, vinegar in the eyes will. If you choose this weed control option, which I sometimes do for weeds in my gravel driveway, be sure and wear eye protection, which you should do when spraying anything other than pure water. But vinegar is just one chemical-free weed control option, and it's probably a poor choice for lawn weeds, as it is a non-selective herbicide that will kill any grass it soaks as well as the weeds. An organic herbicidal soap might be a better choice. And the newest kids on the block, herbicides made from iron, are designed to be very kind to adjacent grasses. But again, if you just care for the grass correctly, weeds will become a serious non-issue. We move on to another great question. This is from Nick in Reinholds, PA, who writes, does horticultural vinegar change the pH of the soil, thus killing the targeted weed? If that weed is close to a plant I wish to keep alive, will it suffer the same consequences as the weed, i.e. death? Or is it simply the spraying of the foliage that causes the death of the weed? Thanks. Well, thank you for those super excellent questions, Nick. And the answer to all of them is yes. As with any contact herbicide, chemical or organic, you'll get the best results when you coat the surface of the undesired plant with a high-strength vinegar at the hottest height of a hot and sunny day, when it hasn't rained for a while and is not predicted to rain again within the next few days. And, as with any contact herbicide, care must be taken to avoid or protect adjacent plants. But as you seem to have figured out, high-strength vinegars also have a quasi-systemic action. They aren't absorbed into the cellular structure of the plant like some chemical herbicides, but they can lower the pH of the soil the plant is growing in below its survival range. In my opinion, this is the best use for the horticultural vinegars. finishing off tough weeds like bamboo and thistle after you've stressed their above-ground growth by repeatedly cutting it back. To achieve this noble end, cut the monster weed back several times beginning in the spring, and then drench the soil around the root systems while that soil is dry on the hottest, driest day of the year. Stress them enough, time it right, use a good amount of the highest acidity vinegar you can find, and you'll achieve an impressive knockdown. Yeah, you'll probably knock down some of the soil life as well, but that life will quickly return as rain and time ease the soil pH back up. In fact, after a month or so, you can even dust some wood ash on the area to get that acidity level closer to normal, a little faster. Well, that sure was some great information about vinegar and other organic weed controls now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can review the question of the week in print at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to dramatically lower the pH around my roots if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if your answer is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solutions to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, just like yours. Hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv, Griffin. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. Sarah Schuhart is his faithful internet companion. Our regular intern, Jessica Mandick, she's back in Disney World. Riding the garden coaster in her place this week is dapper Kevin Collins. Also well-dressed but still stuck working with Goofy here is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. The living e-ticket, Al Banks, is our editor. I'm your host, Mickey Mouse, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. What should aspiring gardeners look for when buying a house? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll name the top factors that make a house a home and a place to grow, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike's working hard to help us forget the deep freeze, perhaps some wise words on wax beans, maybe even a watermelon, whatever you like on plants and gardening. You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 11.